Monday Conference, The Individual and the Marketplace, Freedom and the State, with Professor Emeritus F.A. von Hayek.
Good evening, welcome to the Monday Conference today. Back in 1944, a book was published which went very much against the temper of the time then. Its title was The Road to Serfdom, and what it did was to warn against what its author saw as the inevitable dangers of state planning. The book argued that economic planning led to big government and the shrinking of individual freedom. Motives didn't matter. Any continuing expansion of government for any reason ended in authoritarianism or totalitarianism. The author of The Road to Serfdom was Professor Friedrich Hayek. The book made him famous. It also caused him to be regarded as extremely reactionary in many quarters at the time. In the years since then, Professor Hayek has been both arguing against this view of himself and expanding his views about economics and politics in a great number of books and very many articles indeed. Friedrich Hayek was born in Austria in 1899. He lives there now, but in the meantime, he spent many years teaching in Germany, the United States and Britain, and is a naturalized British citizen. Perhaps the most public highlight of his career was the award to him of a Nobel Prize for Economics in 1974. And in the course of his Alfred Nobel Memorial Lecture, Professor Hayek made these points among others. Economists don't know as much as they think they do. Economists are being called upon to solve a problem, inflation, which is largely the result of their own bad advice in the past. And perhaps most sadly, and here are his direct words, as a profession, we have made a mess of things. But among the other challenging points which emerge from his writings are, individual freedom depends on economic inequality in society. So does economic growth. The more unequal the slices, the bigger the cake. The present high level of unemployment is, ironically, largely the result of governments pursuing full employment policies. So is inflation. Keynes and his followers have been wrong. Trade unions can do little in the long run to raise the general level of real wages, but they do a great deal to lower it. There's no such thing as social justice. It's either a meaningless or a tendentious term. People should not be rewarded according to their presumed need or presumed merit, but according to their value as measured in the marketplace. Professor Hayek, before we get into the substance of the argument, I wonder if I could ask you whether there shouldn't be a special dispensation for professors of economics to be rewarded on the basis of merit or need as well as market value.
No, certainly
not. Not at all.
Not in the least, yes.
Right. Well, now, when we're talking about a free enterprise economy or an economy based on market forces, are we talking about something that's been and gone, or is there a possibility of unscrambling the omelet, as it were, and restoring the whole eggs? Can we do anything about what has happened in the last 50-odd years?
Well, we have approached it at one stage more closely than its present moment, but the gradual abandonment of it is largely the result of intellectual confusion. And I wanted to correct you at the very beginning when you said there was a place to all government action, and for all government action was dangerous. It's not as simple as that. I'm concerned mainly with the coercive powers of government. Now, coercive powers are not the only powers of government. Government can render all kinds of useful services for which it need not use coercion. But I do believe that the coercive powers of government ought to be very strictly limited. That in exercising coercive powers, it ought to be confined by general rules, and that the main task of the economist and social philosopher is really to design an appropriate framework of such general rules within which the spontaneous activities of the individuals will be most beneficial. Now, to a large extent, such a framework has been evolved by a sort of process of spontaneous evolution. But it's not yet ideal, and I would never deny that there is not an important field or task for reform. But this reform, so far as it intended to give the government coercive powers, must be limiting government to the application of uniform equal rules to all.
Professor, I'm sorry, I'm not clear on this. In the real world then, say in societies in what we'll call the West for the moment, is the trend towards more collectivism or more individualism? Which way is the trend going?
Well, the actual trend of legislation is certainly towards more collectivism. The trend of opinion is beginning to be in the opposite direction. When these two things do not completely coincide in time, the present trend of actual policy towards more and more government intervention has been prepared by three generations of intellectual development justifying this. And it's just now that people are beginning to be doubtful about the desirability of this development. And I've now lived long enough to have seen a very curious reversal. When I became concerned about these problems, only the old people were opposed to more government control, and all the young people seem to be enthusiastic about this. Now it's the other way around. The people who are now middle-aged and old have got so used to plenty of government intervention that they readily accept it. And it's the very young people who are becoming very doubtful and skeptical about it. I think that's a hopeful element of the present position.
Well, supposing your philosophical viewpoint wins out, in the harsh world of political realities, would it be able to overcome the vested interests which the present distribution of resources and the present mix of private enterprise and state enterprise favour?
I don't think it could do without considerable alteration of the structure of government as we have it now. We have developed a form of democracy, which unfortunately most people believe is a necessary form of democracy, where the one representative assembly is all-powerful. We are really, although we are not likely to, do not like to admit it, living under an unlimited form of government, where the elected assembly can do whatever it pleases and is no longer in its governmental action under a law which it cannot alter. And that raises a great problem. I believe that the very existing political institutions tend to drive us into more collectivism, more government control, because under what we call democracy, we are not being governed by the opinion of a majority, but the majority which governs us is formed by buying off particular interests. And so long as the government has the power to make specific concessions to particular groups, this is an inevitable development. It's a great paradox that an omniscient or an omnipotent government which can do everything is in effect a very weak government, because you can extort from it assistance to every particular group. An omnipotent government which relies on a majority vote has to buy the support of a sufficient number of groups to have a majority.
You're saying that a democratic government, as we know, wouldn't be brave enough to do what you think is required.
Exactly.
Perhaps we'll come back to it later on. Why did you
let me add one thing. I'm very concerned about this, because the particular form of democracy which exists now is gradually discrediting democracy in public opinion. And I'm quite certain that in 5 or 10 years' time, the opinion will have spread democracy has failed. What has failed is not democracy as such, it's a particular form of democracy which we have failed.
In your Nobel Memorial Lecture, why did you say, speaking of economists, we have made a mess of things? Now, can I ask you this? Why have economists made a mess of things? Why have they? What, are they blind or are they...
No, it was the seduction of a very impressive and ingenious man, John Maynard Keynes, who persuaded the economists that there was a simple way of permanently securing full employment. He was wrong, but it was exceedingly persuasive. And he had gained the support of probably 95% of the current commercial economists. And I've been arguing against this ever since. I've been arguing with him while he was still alive Well, there was no chance of getting a hearing so long as it seemed plausible that by a simple monetary device you could assure full employment. And that monetary device was in fact of such a nature that in the short run you could do it. That in fact at the same time you created distortions of the structure of the economy, which in the long run was bound to bring about unemployment, were things which a few of us had pointed out, but which seemed to be in contradiction with the actual experience. Currently it worked beautifully. That we have been predicting you will have to pay for this in the future, people just wouldn't listen to you. And what we have predicted has come to be very true. We found out that the Keynesian method of creating employment by accelerating inflation works only for a limited period and creates a condition for following unemployment. And that is a state of disillusionment in which we are now. A great many economists feel that what they have learned, I mean, economists who have been trained between the middle 30s and the present, now finding out that have been taught a wrong doctrine.
One last point. What is the relationship between equality and liberty? And if we have to choose one, which one do we choose?
But equality, like most political terms, is a term of a great many meanings. Equality before the law, the application of the same rule to every citizen, is an absolute essential foundation of liberty. But if you have equality before the law, you cannot make people materially equal, because people are, in fact, very unequal in their gifts, in their environment, in their opportunities. And if you want to make people who are very unequal in their gifts and opportunities equal, you have to treat them differently. So in this sense, treating under the same rule and making people equal are absolutely in conflict. I'm all in favor by treating people under the same rule for equality under the law. But I'm all against governmental effort of making people equal, because that requires treating them differently.
Thank you. Now, is there anyone? Yes, in the second place.
In Australia, we enjoy greater quality of income distribution through the populace. Under your policies, how much would this change, and would the change be good or bad, both economically and socially?
Well, I hope I have understood. I would say that no correction of income distribution is compatible with a functioning economic system beyond providing a flat uniform minimum for everybody, a sort of floor below which nobody can sink. That can and should be provided outside the market without interfering with the market order. But the market order owes its efficiency and productivity to the fact that people are being paid what their services are actually worth to their fellow members. And the worth of a person's services to his fellow citizens is unfortunately frequently quite independent of his merits or needs. Therefore, we cannot have an efficient society which at the same time is just in the sense of distribution. We can have society in which nobody need to suffer acute distress. But that's as much as we can hope. We cannot hope to have a society of free men in which people get what we think they ought to have.
I think there's a second part to the question. Apart from the matter of welfare or equity, or whatever we call it, what are the economic consequences of inequality of wealth?
That greater productivity.
I thought you argued that economic growth depended on inequality of.
Professor Hayek, wouldn't you accept the prognosis that the market value of anybody, whether they're professional or laboring, is a created and fictitious value created by the mass media today?
Yes. And yet I believe that on the whole, the mass media are merely an expression of public opinion. Now, I've got great respect for public opinion, but I think in a peaceful society we have to defer to public opinion. And so long as the mass media themselves are competitive, I have no objection. I become very doubtful about it where you have a broadcasting monopoly in similar institutions. Then it does become dangerous.
Now, Professor Hayek, I submit that your views and the views of Professor Friedman are very much akin to the views of the present Australian government and the present Australian Treasury, which have been responsible for our present level of unemployment of 300,000, which will rise certainly to 400,000 by the end of this year. Now, I submit in those circumstances that that kind of policy, which will give us something like 500,000 towards the end of next year, will give us 3 years of substantial unemployment without any significant trade-off in terms of inflation. I find it very difficult to appreciate how you can justify an economic policy which you say in your writings is short-term as a means of achieving full employment, short-term unemployment as a means of achieving full employment. After 3 years, we've had substantial unemployment, no trade-off. Now, the fundamental factor of the Australian economy, of course, is that we've had a substantial cutback in consumer demand, a substantial cutback in private investment. Those economies that have recovered, Japan, United States, West Germany, and of course Sweden that's had no unemployment, are the ones that have substantially raised their public spending. And in the Reserve Bank report, which is not a radical report, the Reserve Bank report this year states quite bluntly that the Japanese economy's recovery has been based on public sector spending. Now, in those circumstances, with a decline in consumer demand, a decline in private investment, how do you justify the argument that there should not have been a reflation through additional public sector spending?
Well, I'm not sure that I have followed it in all detail, and certainly would require a long discussion. I think the basic fact is still that those countries who over the past 5 or 10 years have managed to maintain a very high rate of inflation, of employment, by a high rate of inflation, are now suffering worse from unemployment.
Had both low unemployment and low inflation with high levels of public spending.
Well, that happens to be a case I know fairly well on which I can talk. Germans have had, well, I really must begin a little earlier. Now, the basic problem is that with the new Keynesian economics, they have given a charter to the trade unions to ask as much as they want and imposed the duty on the monetary authorities to offset this by providing enough money. Now, the German situation, up to quite recently, was very different from a simple reason. The trade union leaders had experienced and knew what inflation really meant. And all you needed to do in Germany, if a trade union ever asked too much, is to raise a finger, be careful, you will be caused unemployment, and the trade union leaders would collapse. It never made excessive demands, and it never was necessary to offset excessive trade union demands by inflation. In that respect, Germany is, or I'm afraid I must say it was, rather exceptional. Because that generation of trade union leaders, which had an acute experience of inflation, is now going off duty. It's replaced by a younger generation who no longer understands this. I think Germany is now going to get into exactly the same difficulty as other countries. It will have a position in which the trade unions make high demands in complete disregard of the effect of their demands on employment, in the confidence that it's the duty of government to provide enough money that at these high rates full employment will be maintained. Now that is the whole situation now. I mean, there's been a great deal of dispute about whether wage pressure can cause cause inflation. Now there's confusion about it. Wage pressure as such could not cause inflation if the government did not provide the additional money. Wage pressure would, with a constant supply of money, lead to unemployment. But in the situation which existed in the last 25 years, the trade unions need not concern themselves about it, because it was the recognized duty of the government or central bank to provide enough money that any wage rate they enforced, they would be full employment. So there is this complex interaction. Wage pressure exposes the government to the choice, either allowing unemployment to occur or to produce inflation. Now the answer was to inflate, by which it temporarily avoided the effect of the wage pressure. It did not happen in Germany for the reasons I have mentioned, that the German trade unions understood this, and all you had to do then is to point out to them, if you asked for more, you would have inflation, and they gave in. Now that will no longer be true in the future. So I think we should have in all Europe the same position, that the pressure for higher wages will make it necessary to meet it by more monetary expansion, which governments cannot resist, and so we'll have more inflation.
Well, very briefly, you had a pretty fair run. I'd really rather have somebody else who takes it.
In those circumstances, why can't you have a social contract with the trade union movement to reduce wage growth and at the same time maintain high levels of public spending? It would seem to me that there'd be no case for your policy of having small government if at the same time you can get a social contract with the trade union movement to hold down the level of wages that's occurred, of course, in Sweden.
Because such a social contract completely suspends the mechanism of the adjustment of relative wages, which of course is essential for full employment. I mean, you need a continuous adjustment of wages relative to the other, which can only be done by the market. You cannot politically determine what some wages are allowed to rise and others are not. So a social contract produces absolute rigidity of the wage structure.
Certainly not the case.
It has something in England.
Now, my friend, what was it you wanted to say? We've upset you.
No, you haven't upset me. I want to ask, governments have got the power to reduce interest rates.
To do?
To reduce interest rates. The government have got the power. Now, the government of this country have been telling people for weeks to go out and spend. They've been telling business people to expand their business and to employ people. Now, with the high interest rate, anybody with any money would not be right in their heads if they did not invest their money in the marketplace where they can get 14, 15% interest with no risk whatsoever.
Well, of course, in the present situation, the higher interest rates are an effect of inflation and not the other way around. But let me add here that I have come to the conclusion that so long as the control of money is in the hands of democratic government, there is no chance at all of getting a sensible monetary policy. And my latest and very serious suggestion is that we ought to take from government the monopoly of issuing money and allow private enterprise to do so. Don't laugh. I have come to the conclusion that it was the fact that private enterprise has not been allowed to provide us with decent money, which the public like to use, but that we are forced to use the government money, that the main weakness ascribed to capitalism, industrial fluctuations, are really due. If private enterprise had been allowed to provide itself with decent money, we'd have long ago escaped industrial fluctuations.
When you say money, do you mean money?
I mean money.
Private enterprise.
Yes.
Coining its own coins.
Just to make one mistake, because I do not suggest that competing firms should all be allowed to issue dollars. I think we would have to issue monies with different denominations which would compete with each other and give the public the opportunity to use the money which they trusted. Those who abuse their position would very soon be driven out of the market, and the few would survive and provide us with, would survive because they provided us with decent money.
Yes, in the
Firstly, you say that incomes are decided in the marketplace, and so that's why there's inequality. Well, and you also say that incomes are a product of the worth of society, of a certain person's activity in the marketplace. So why is it that the activity of people in the boardroom of a company like BHP is worth more than the activity of somebody who works for BHP and actually produces the steel?
It's BHP, I'm sorry.
Oh, it's the biggest company in Australia.
Australian steel manufacturing company.
You need to know, isn't it, really? That's in our terms, an enormous company.
Well, in the main point about a market order is that incomes are determined by a great number of circumstances which nobody knows. And it is necessary for a functioning market that the determination of incomes is affected by all these circumstances. Therefore, no attempt deliberately to regulate relative incomes can provide incomes which will assure a functioning market. The market incomes have that great advantage that in them there is precipitated, as I call it, as I like to call it, the effect of the knowledge of hundreds of thousands of people whose demand and supply affect the market and which create this order in which dispersed knowledge is used to maximum effect, something which men control, either by government or by monopolies, can equal.
You say that these forces create order. What would disorder be? How would you know?
Well, disorder, for instance, a position where in every market the demand and supply do not equal, and therefore people can either not sell what they hope to sell or what they tried to produce for selling, or cannot buy what they expect to buy. An orderly market is where, on the whole, the expectations which have guided people's efforts are being borne out. And that, of course, is a normal condition of affairs. We owe our income to the fact that in the majority of instances, the expectations which have guided people's income in producing are being borne out, and people are in consequence able to continue producing what they have. It's always only a very small proportion of them who are forced by disappointment of their expectation to change it. Now, this force to change your plans is a necessary part of this adjustment process.
We have state boards which are set up precisely to bring about orderly markets.
Well, that's what people believe, yes, but it certainly doesn't do it.
Right at the back, on the aisle, yes, with the glasses and the...
The first is a comment and the second is a question. I'm curious about Professor Hayek's attitude to the role of the state.
Attitude to?
The role of the state.
The role of the state, yes. Because he shares, if it is taken to its logical conclusion, this attitude with another 19th century economist, Marx. That is, the withering away of the state. Professor might comment on this. The second one is, what is Professor Hayek's attitude towards anti-monopoly or antitrust legislation, for example, in the United States? And does he think that it has been sufficiently effective in ensuring that the market operates in the way in which he would like it to see operate?
Well, there's really three issues. Let me take them up one by one. So far as the ordinary process of production and distribution are concerned, the whole necessary function of the state is to provide a framework of legal rules within which this process will proceed fairly, steadily, and efficiently. In addition to this, providing and enforcing a framework of rule for the market, there are certain services which the market cannot provide, what is commonly known as public goods, things which already Adam Smith knew, that there are certain services which they are rendered at all, must be rendered to everybody, and not only to people who are willing to pay for it, which for this reason the market cannot, in the present state of affairs, provide. Now such services the government ought to provide, although I must at once add the proviso. The fact that it's desirable that the government step in and provide them does not mean that the government ought to have a monopoly of doing so, because it is usually a temporary position which makes it impossible for private enterprise to do so. And to give you just one illustration, I mean, it was argued not very long ago that the government monopoly of broadcasting was necessary because anyone who broadcast could not confine his service to those who were willing to pay, so you had to put it in the hands of government. Now, we know now that it can either be financed by advertising, and it certainly would have led to the development of devices which made it possible to confine the reception of a particular broadcast to the people who are willing to pay for it. That has not taken place because in most countries the government has been given some monopoly and there was no incentive to do it. Now, at the second point, I concede that apart from enforcing the framework of legal rules which we need to secure personal freedom and the functioning market, government ought to render certain services but have no monopoly of rendering these services. The third question was what need government to do to prevent monopoly? Well, my main answer is a very simple one, not to assist it. Because most monopolies which exist are due to the assistance rendered to it by government, and there are very few monopolies which would exist if government did not assist them by import tariffs, by the peculiar form of our law of industrial patents, by the peculiar form of our law of industrial organization. And I believe that if we removed the various forms in which government assists the formation of private monopoly, there would be very little left to worry about. There might still be a few. I think we might need some development of the rules of competition. I have been much playing with the idea of enforcing some sort of non-discrimination rule, which probably would greatly help in preventing the development of monopolies. But let me repeat, I believe that if we really could persuade government not to help protecting monopoly, the remaining monopolies would be very uninteresting and unimportant.
Amiralis, would it be a...
Professor Hayek, if we may go back to your book in which you forecast the tyranny of socialism, my question is in two parts. Firstly, how do people living under the tyrannies of socialism, as in the countries of Eastern Europe, reform their government, liberate themselves, without creating a bloodbath at the same time? Secondly, how do people living in semi-socialist societies, such as Australia, dismantle the system without at the same time provoking a reaction from monopoly trade unions which might wreck the economy?
You know, to answer this, I must draw your attention to what socialism meant 40 years ago when I read that book. At that time, socialism had a very precise meaning. The nationalization of the means of production, distribution, and exchange. The transfer of all industrial equipment under the control of the state and central economic planning. Now, I still would maintain that all countries which have attempted this form of socialism corresponding to the original Marxian tradition all have turned totalitarian. But the fact is that since I wrote the Road to Serfdom, and perhaps partly because this danger was recognized, a socialist have changed their program and have attempted very largely to achieve their ultimate goal of changing the distribution of incomes, not by controlling production, but by taking money by taxation and redistributing it. Now that creates a somewhat different problem. And if you really could, in the long, it creates a somewhat different problem, and has at least greatly slowed down the process, which I think would have been very rapid, if the socialist government had stuck with their initial program of nationalization and central planning. Now this distributionist socialism, if I may call it that, acts much more slowly and, of course, doesn't require or doesn't seem to require that governments undertake complete control of industry. Most of you will know that, for instance, Sweden, which is supposed to be a highly socialist country, has nationalized fewer industries than any other country of Europe. It has completely shifted from the traditional concept of socialism, meaning government direction of industry, to a redistributionist socialism. Now, I personally believe, but that's a very long and complex story, that this form of redistributionist socialism leads much more slowly and indirectly to the same result as the direct one. Because in constantly interfering with the price mechanism in order to transform enough income, you make the market more and more inefficient and are driven by your own measures to interfere more and more. So what I would say is that the changed strategy of the socialists has postponed the evil day, has made it less imminent. I think we're still tending in the same direction. But I would have to write a second book to deal with this form of socialism to complement what I said in my discussion of the traditional orthodox type of socialism.
Professor, you have argued that the law of property and contract sets the rules for our market economy. And I am pointing out that a very large part of production in our economy is not set by any such laws. And in fact, there is no guarantee whatsoever that those who contribute through those activities will receive a fair wage.
Now, the law of property need not provide that everybody has property. It merely requires that the disposal of material assets is governed by the process of competition. I mean, the system of property, even if it gives property only to a few, still benefits all, because the fact that property is being used according to considerations of the market makes it very much more efficient than it would be under any other system. The aim is not to give property to those whom it will most benefit, but to give it to those who use it most beneficially. And that are, in the market system, those who use it most profitably.
On this point, following up?
Yes.
Yes.
Please. Professor Bonner, you are wrong in everything. First, you are not logically consistent. Secondly, your theories are morally bankrupt. And finally, they do not have any empirical validity whatsoever. And I'll point out one by one. First one, as in the market mechanism, first, it doesn't exist except in your mind. In real life, it doesn't exist. And the poor people, especially the poorest section of the population at the national level, would always be deprived of their legitimate share. They'll be out of the mainstream of the market mechanism. At the international level, the poor countries will never be able to participate to their fullest extent. There'll be aggression of the strongest country, richer countries, stronger people. And morally, it's a bankrupt because you are giving us the law of jungle, survival of the fittest, survival of the strongest, so there will be no more orphanage, no more old people, no more unemployed people. Shoot them out. Finally, empirically, if you look at the history the way we look, I'm not going to mention about the socialist countries which don't have any inflation, don't have any unemployment because of the government supervision, but even Paul Samuelson, another Nobel laureate, in his latest issue of Newsweek, pointed out that income equality, equality of distribution of income, wealth, and property, leads to more efficiency and more economic growth. So what you are suggesting are totally empirically wrong and not accepted by anybody in this world.
Well, you know, I don't want to trade discourtesies with you. But I might just take you up on your last sentence in which you assure that the things which I have said are not believed by anybody in this world. I mean, I think if you reflect for a moment, you would have to admit that this is a sheer untruth. And I think I will leave it at this, you're being self-convicted, because that applies to the rest of your statement.
There is one topic that was mentioned, though, that no one's touched on yet, and I think this is an important case to deal with. In your view, what should be the attitude of countries like Australia to the developing countries? Is there, you know, how does this fit in? Where does, what values do we use to decide what degree of aid we should give, or any at all, or to whom, or how, or whatever?
Well, I think the first principle is not to give a penny to any country who uses it for socialistic experiments, because, you know, it's being wasted. I don't want to give any money where it's not going to help the people whom it is intended to help. I think, secondly, we might well make arrangements which provide capital for investment where it will be profitably invested. And I think that we contribute very much more, and has in the past contributed very much more to raising the standard of living of the people of the countries concerned than any intergovernmental lending which handed over to government money, which they almost invariably wasted. I mean, if you really look around in your neighborhood, I would say, from a world point of view, I mean, Eastern Asia and Oceania, there are a few underdeveloped countries who tried it the capitalist way, South Korea and Taiwan and Singapore, who have succeeded magnificently and have had a rise of average incomes, which is not equaled either by the Western world or by the other underdeveloped countries, the socialist way. So I think the empirical evidence is all against financing. I mean, I would really put it that way. Let the big socialist countries finance the socialist underdeveloped countries, and the big capitalist countries finance the underdeveloped capitalist countries, and we would get two parts of the world, one rapidly developing, because it did it the capitalist way, and one hardly developing at all, because it did it the socialist way.
This is not true. Look at China. Did you know anything about China, mainland China? before 1949, when it used to follow so-called capitalistic way for donkey years, it was one of the poorest countries in the world. I have been to China and I come from India. China follows socialistic
power. But so was Taiwan at that time, and Taiwan has become a rich country and China has remained poor.
No, I did not come from China. Ideal of convergence is between India and China, not between Taiwan and China. Taiwan is a small country and China is a big country.
Well, I think a big country, according to all traditional beliefs, a big country has much better chances than a small country. And India, which you mentioned, is certainly a country which has destroyed all its chances by a very silly socialist policy.
At the back. Yes?
Your policies differ from those put forward by the Australian government and adopted by it and other Western governments in 1929.
Well, what I would not do is what the American government did in the end of the 20s, that when an inflationary boom was on the point of breaking in 27, artificially prolonging it by more inflation by another 2 years, with the result that the amount of misdirection of activities, of distortion of the structure, became very serious. I think the abuse of money, which caused the Great Depression, began during the preceding inflationary period. That then, in addition, once the crisis had come, the Federal Reserve System, not only permitted, but actually assisted a violation of proven promise, it certainly ought to be considered very seriously.
So, we've got to go, but I'm wondering if you're more optimistic about the economists of the future than have been about the economists of the past.
Yes, I believe I said so already at the beginning for one very specific reason, that when I was young, only the old people believed in the traditional system, and we young, including myself, were all very critical of it. By now, when I've grown old, I find that my contemporaries believe in that mixed system, but the young are beginning to revolt for it. And for my particular ideas about returning to economic freedom, I find now in most parts of the world, even if it doesn't seem to be so in this room, in most parts of the world, more sympathy among the people in their early 20s than among the old people. And that makes me very optimistic.
And in your particular terms, are you optimistic or pessimistic about our chances of getting out of the unemployment, inflation complex in the Australian state?
More optimistic only in a very limited sense. I think we know now how it can be done. But the intervals from knowing till this is actually being used by politics may well be a generation or so. So I think for the near future, I am not optimistic. I think we are going to cause, by our own politics, a great deal more trouble than is necessary. But I think we are on the way of learning, and though I shall not live to see it, I rather anticipate that so in 30 years' time, we shall have learned to master this particular problem.
Professor Hayek, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monday Conference. Thank you, everyone else, too, for your contribution to the program tonight. There'll be another Monday Conference next week. Till then, good night.
Come from the Sydney Opera House. Our special guest is the visiting economist and Nobel laureate, Professor F.A. von Hayek. Monday Conference can be seen again tomorrow at noon. Next tonight, The Stones Cry Out.